Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
Show will match the intensity of the last 10 minutes here. Welcome to my space. Well, in this cyber little environment we're in here. Unfreaking believable. Dr. Mark here, your host. The number to call to Wine and Dime me is, 646-478-4847. Thank you, Buggles, for the opening number. As we take a little look under the hood of the social media landscape this week as we get a little business on our mind. Because, you know, I've had a really rough summer. I don't know about you. Trying to think about my fiscal future. Because in the healthcare industry, which I dangle in, I used to dabble. Now I dangle. That cash cow is dead. If you're a clinician, it's as easy as fishing. You could be a clinician. And what we're faced with now is a different environment. We have to suddenly get into this whole other venue of promoting ourselves. And, you know, you remember when they used to not let doctors advertise? You know, when they said, you know, that was like, you know, looked at as being unethical. Now, forget it. Every doctor is a cottage industry. If I say, you know, Dr. Oz, you don't have to know what the hell the guy's about. The other guy, Gupta, there on CNN. Every doctor is a Fraser Crane. I'm one of them. I'm guilty of it. But I'm not listening. And most of you aren't either. That's right.
You filthy criminies.
Yeah. So I figured I'd get somebody who knew about this before the learning curve was going to be applied to us, and maybe we get some answers. So how do we cope with the fact that the game has radically changed? And what is really, it's come down to, have all the old school values of doing hard work and establishing relationships with people and being as good as your handshake and all that kind of stuff, has that gone away? Do we not care about that anymore? And is it much more about being able to promote and to sort of get in people's heads and establish this this piperness that goes on with things like the damn secret, which we'll get into. Actually, our guest has a unique position on that. And then the other thing is that we've sort of blurred the line with all these industries now, because the whole coaching universe has sort of exploded because everybody needs HEP, not help. Hep. I need hep. I don't have time to say help. I need hep. Hep. That's what you say when you're drowning. Help me. Help me, please. And so you've seen a whole industry rise up from executive coaching, business acceleration coaching, motivational this coaching, marketing that coaching. Everyone's coaching everybody. And actually right now there's a sports psychologist dialing into Mike Pelfrey's agent here as they're watching the Mets implode tonight. Sixth inning, they trail the Marlins 4-3, mostly because Mike Pelfrey is a maniac. We're going to get into all that, but first, I still got to get a theme song for this, but we have a new swine flu report. And if you've been watching the news, and I have, as the Mets, I don't know what's going on over there now. Looks like it's still 4-3 with two outs. The report, you know, this week, the forecast, and the forecast is, you know, there's going to be some pain because they're talking about a lot of the people in healthcare actually are saying that they're not going to get the vaccine when it comes out, which is so cool that they're resisting this. And I just think it's great. So despite the fears of an impending swine flu pandemic, all right, oh, that's what happened. There's two outs because he dropped the ball, so it is 5-3. Murphy having another stellar game. Anyway, if you're watching the Mets, I recommend getting the vaccine and waiting for the side effects to kick in to help you cope with this. So anyway, more than half the healthcare workers in Hong Kong say they will not be getting vaccinated. All right, the reason? Fear of side effects and doubts about the vaccine's efficacy. To our knowledge, this is the largest study conducted to assess the willingness of healthcare workers to accept pre-pandemic influenza vaccinations and provides important information on barriers to the vaccination. Campaigns to promote the vaccination should consider addressing the knowledge gap of staff and specific target groups for intervention. So more than 8,500 healthcare workers, including doctors and nurses, were surveyed, and they're saying, hell no, I will not get stuck with that poison dart. So now, in the United States, the officials predict as much as 50% of the population, and everyone in Wisconsin, could be infected, with a possible death toll, of 90,000 or more, triple the number lost to seasonal flu every year. So it's coming. The swine friend is coming. And the healthcare workers don't want this shot. So, you know, a little more grist for the mill on the old swine friend front. Swine friend front. And we're going to hopefully get a guest on in a couple of weeks to talk about what you could do to naturally boost your immunity, both from the real virus and the media virus. Oh, for the love of... there's a little single on the right, and Pelfrey's going to make sure now. It's a two-run lead, but he's going to make sure he buries us. This pitching staff is... there should be a vaccine against this. Against watching this guy pitch with two outs. He's terrible. They're finally taking him out of the game. I hope for the sake of the fans that Jerry Manuel punches him in the kidneys as he leaves the mound. And they're going to bring in some other stiff for the bullpen now. This is the Mets, folks. Meet the Mets. I'll be putting out my ADD here for you. I'll be putting out my little third quarter report on the state of the Mets on blogsoma.net probably tomorrow if I get to it tonight. But just to kind of look at the last 50 games or so when everything went into the dumper and why it did and what happened on a somatic front. Speaking of that, go to somaspace.org because that's where we get all the material up there for the work we're doing here in Larchmont and also the work we'd like to do online about the four domains, the amazing four domains. And you can check that out at somaspace.org. And it gets into some of the things. I don't know if you picked up a Psychology Today yet for October, but it's a great article. And we have a guest on in September, Sam Gosling from University of Texas. And he talks about these sort of missed or misinterpreted personality traits. This is called mixed signals, and these are basically why people feel misunderstood when it comes to the typing. And he breaks down the shy extrovert, the bubbly introvert, and the accidental flirt, and my favorite, the effeminate heterosexual, and how people misread them based on the way their body language and their behavior and their facial expressions. So it's very cool stuff. So we're going to have Sam on here, Sam I Am, from the University of Texas, to talk about that whole kind of budding industry of social and personality psychology and see if we can get a little soma in there. But the four domains pertain to this, as they will to our guest tonight. Because if you're buying something, you're really not buying the thing. You're buying what the person that relayed that to you. That's why this whole explosion about truth in advertising, you know, the whole Oprah thing with, I think it is Dr. Oz, you know, with the Acai Berry stuff, putting a celebrity next to a product to sell it. And does the celebrity really use the product, or does the celebrity really endorse the product? And now you got Twitter getting in the way. So we got a lot of things to sort out here. Like I said, the game has changed. And, you know, no one told us. No one told us. So without further ado, as I get the horn here. Submarine stop, and our passenger this week, all the way from the West Coast, I think. I don't know where he is right now, but he lives in Boise, Idaho. It's Dave Licani. Welcome to the Summertime from boldapproach.com.
Thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, the meanderings in the Twitterverse continue here. Maybe you can give me an insight on this, because I don't know if you caught the story today about Oprah and Dr. Oz suing about 40 companies for using their name and likeness to sell their Acai Berry products, the diet products, that have been all over the web. And
yeah.
And how does that work from a you kind of have a full circle impression of the way this industry has really kind of been both butchered and battered in the last 2 or 3 years. Have the celebrities abused it and now they're getting their comeuppance, or is it one of these cases of sort of the nature of the net is to be sort of exploitative and they just sort of capitalized on the fact that they had a little YouTube clip of them and, you know, patched it in there?
Well, I think it's the nature of spammers and those kind of people to be exploitive. I don't think that media has necessarily been exploitive of people for the purpose explicitly of of making money by selling a product. I think quite the opposite is true. I just actually had my attorney send an email to one of those companies who was using my likeness and a video testimonial of me from another site to promote their Acai Berry weight loss product.
Oh, you're in it too.
Literally,
okay.
Last week, yeah. So I'm definitely fall down on the side of, you know, you don't get to use somebody who has some level of, and not suggesting at all that I'm a celebrity, but some, I'm going to use that word, some level of celebrity or some level of recognition to, to endorse your product or service without having their prior permission. It's just not acceptable.
Yeah, and it just seems like because the internet is so vast and so anonymous and so sort of stealth that this stuff gets away with murder. And then sometimes you go to some of these message boards and you see people, you know, that have been taken advantage of, and a lot of money just seems to be, it's almost like a nuisance fee. They abuse people, they get their money, and then they spend all kinds of time trying to get their money back, and then basically it gets settled under the radar and they're off to do it again with something else. It really is sort of a roving sort of digital ninja thing going on out there. And as someone like yourself that lives and breathes through this social universe here that's digitally just expanding and getting more and more advanced. How do you, again, for the clients that you work with, how do you kind of protect that image that you so meticulously create if it could just be lifted and you know, sort of, to use a word, kind of photoshopped into somebody else's vehicle?
Well, I think you have to pay attention, number one, and I think that's a thing that, you know, that anybody who's fairly public online is doing a lot better now. You know, paying very close attention and making sure that they're doing all that they can to protect their privacy. I think they're leveraging not just their privacy, but their, you know, their images and all of those things. And they're making sure that that they take appropriate actions. The most important thing that you can do, though, is pay attention. You can monitor, you know, using Google Alerts, using, you know, tools in Twitter and all of that to monitor what people are saying and where, you know, where your images and names are showing up. But it's a constant effort to make sure that you not only monitor it but police it as well and make sure that you, make sure that you know what people are saying about you and how you can respond to it. What's legal and allowed and what isn't, and make sure that you're very thorough about it. Because if not, you know, you can implied endorsements can also lead to liability issues and all kinds of things. So, you know, Dr. Oz apparently promoting something and somebody, you know, does it, uses something and ends up interacting poorly with medication or with themselves and they end up getting hurt, and suddenly he's included in a lawsuit. And he never had anything to do with it anyway.
Right. And again, this is one of these kind of gray areas that I guess is becoming a little bit more gray, is the whole concept of intellectual property has become, in the open source world, has become sort of like, especially with Twitter and the retweeting and all that stuff, has become a little bit more difficult to enforce, because if you put something out on your Twitter page or your Facebook page, like Sarah Palin has found out, people are watching, and they will take that information and they will cut and paste it and link it and all kinds of crazy things. And you really have no influence or control over what happens if you put something on the web that could be taken out of context and misconstrued, and then your idea, your intellectual property, your concept can become co-opted by other people. And that's why all these, the idea of all these knockoff items and things like that, it's sort of become a cottage industry for lawyers that are basically sitting around watching this game being played. So someone comes up with an idea, they work really hard and they've created it and they're trying to market it on the web, and these sort of, you know, kind of vipers are sitting there waiting for this thing to attract attention, and then they're just kind of, you know, like I said, they're co-opted. And one of the ones that I love to beat up here, which you have almost hung in effigy, I guess, at this point, is The Secret.
Yeah.
Now, you have an interesting background with respect to The Secret. So tell the folks about your experiences with cults. And this is, I read it in your bio, and you can go to boldapproach.com, read all about, you know, what Dave's been through and been up to, and some of the things he found out about the human psyche. But tell us about, like, your history with that, and then
sure,
how that leads up to your opinion about The Secret.
Well, I grew up in a very strict religious cult from the time I was 6 until I was 16. They believed in no education past 6th or 7th grade. They believed in women being subservient to their husbands or corporal punishment was allowed. They believed in no television, no radio, no dancing. They believed in an end-time prophet named William Branham. They believed he was the literal resurrection of the prophet Elijah from the Bible. And they were very, very, just very strict in their beliefs and in the way they did things. You know, you weren't allowed to marry outside of the church. You weren't allowed to do the list of things you couldn't do was very long. Women couldn't wear garments that pertained to a man, so no pants, no cutting their hair, no jewelry, those kind of things. And so that's the kind of organization I grew up from the time I was 6 until I was 16. When I was 16, I'd sort of seen the light, so to speak, and decided that I had to leave. And so I was literally excommunicated from the church by having to come up onto the pulpit for one last time. They laid their hands on me, prayed to God he would turn my soul over to Satan for the destruction of my flesh, that
really?
I would be killed for my transgressions. Yeah.
Talk
and then sent me on my way.
Yeah. What's,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, very nice way to be sent on my way. But
was
I wasn't allowed to talk to my family.
Was it Seventh Day?
No, they're not Seventh Day Adventists at all. They are. Oh. They believed in an. They're called Branhamites or believers,
okay.
Bible believers, and they are. There's about 3.5 million of them in the world today, and they believed in this end time prophet named William Branham, who died in 1965. But his sons now run the organization.
And this is what part of the country did you grow up in that had this happen?
Well, they're headquartered in Jeffersonville, Indiana. We moved to Idaho to open up a church here and to get it started. We built that to about 200 to 300 people here in Idaho, and there's still an organization here in Idaho that exists. But they're all over the United States and all over the world. In fact, they're very big in Africa, very big in the Caribbean and other areas.
So then, jump cut, you went back in and became someone who actually infiltrated these kinds of cults and led to your work in persuasion and sales, and it was fascinating stuff. So it's like you got out, you realized that you didn't want to be there anymore, and of course they wished you nothing but well things on the way out the door, and, you know, here's your travel kit. And then at what point do you go into mainstream culture and sales and training, that using this as your foundation, which is, you know, kind of an odd way in?
Well, when I left the organization, I was cut off from my family. They weren't allowed to talk to me or me to them. And my first stop after I left was at the Carnegie Public Library, and I began studying sales, marketing, persuasion, influence, psychology of decision making, the psychology of belief, the heuristics of decision making, all of those kind of things, so that I could understand exactly how that worked. And then I had a long career in between that and where I got to today. But that study started 27 years ago, probably about 20 years ago, I began applying it to business and applying it to sales and understanding exactly how people would act and interact in direct sales when I was selling directly, you know, for companies that I worked for or in companies that I owned, and then began doing consulting, developing large-scale persuasion strategies for companies that were selling products and services around the world.
Okay, so you really, basically, I mean, again, the formula is the same. I always, you know, kind of get the system is neutral. It's your intent can steer it positive or negatively, but persuasion is neutral. It can go, you know, you can persuade people for positive intentions or negative intentions. And I think one of the things that we want to get into with this leads into this dopey secret is that what people were presented with, it's a little bit like one of those hollow Easter egg bunnies that you think is solid, you know?
Yeah.
They give you the presentation that, first of all, this is esoteric, ancient knowledge that hardly anyone knows. And then, of course, when they actually present the idea, and if you're tuning in late, I'm beating up the law of attraction again. It's 9:20 in the East Coast. Usually once a week we pick this thing out and beat it up like a rubber doll. And they do it in isolation. They do it basically, they're talking right to you as the individual, just like the infomercials work. And One of the trouble spots I have from a somatic standpoint is that they do it the opposite way most of the other ways that you see things marketed. They do it from a kinesthetic anchor in the beginning of you need, and then they flash all the usual stuff at you, money, success, great relationship, and it all comes from what? This law of attraction that you didn't know about till 5 minutes ago. So mm-hmm. Give us your kind of sort of like cross-section of What is your issues with it, and why should it be, you know, basically taken out of the consciousness stream if it can possibly be extracted at this point?
Well, A, there's no valid science behind it, although they try and co-opt science all the time and say that you know that quantum physics explains it and those kind of things, and quantum physics does nothing to explain why some people are rich and some people are not rich, or why some people get cancer and other people don't.
Is, like, for example, that the concept of you create your own reality a falsehood?
I don't believe that necessarily you create your own reality is a falsehood, but okay. I think that saying that creating that by being a certain way, by thinking good thoughts, for example, that good things will happen to you just because you thought good thoughts. Creating your own reality to me means that I decide to set goals and do things, and I set about them and take action and do the things that are required that we know are required because they've been done before. Other people have accomplished them. We recreate a series of successes by doing the things that people have already done. So if I want to become a better swimmer, I go to a swimming coach and they show me how to improve my stroke or do something better than I've been doing. I don't just sit around and think, you know, I want to be a better swimmer and I'll be nicer to other people who are swimming with me and all those kind of things and great things will happen to me. Now, the other thing about it is that I would have had a lot less problem with the whole idea of the law of attraction had it not been couched the way it was, if they would have said, you know, the reticular activating system in your brain, for example, helps you see and find more of the kinds of things that you put into the process saying we want to look for. So probably the best way to explain the reticular activating system, when you go buy a new car, you know, you see a car, you think, oh my God, I love that car. Nobody's got it. I'll be one of the few people to have it here. You go buy the car, and then you drive it off a lot, and you begin to notice that there's these cars everywhere. Everybody has one. You start seeing them now because not only are they in your consciousness, but your reticular activating system is out there looking for similar kinds of things. So what we know does work, for example, when we program our brain by saying, I want more of a certain kind of thing, that our brain goes out and begins looking for that. But this is not magic. This is how we're wired as human beings. But no matter how much I sit around and think, okay, I'm a really good person and I really want these things, and because I think good thoughts about you, and I think good thoughts about other people, and I hold this best intention in mind, but I don't do anything, nothing will happen. Things don't just happen in magic. So I put out a giant challenge to people and said, listen, I'll give you all my money. If I can seal you in a hyperbaric chamber, and you can attract $1, a drink of water, or a scrap of food to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, they can't do that. It's impossible. And
but
so
the law of attraction would say you're just not trying hard enough, right?
Well, the law of attraction, they propose it in The Secret. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
It would happen.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you say that complete countries of people where genocide is occurring on a regular basis did something to deserve that, you re-victimize those people. When you say that a small child who was raped, tortured, and murdered somehow attracted that to themselves, that's just pure insanity, and it makes no sense at all. And even, you know, even if you believe in ancient, you know, ancient religions like Hinduism or Buddhism, where karma or reincarnation may be involved, and you may believe that, you know, that you bring on these things from past lives, it certainly does not explain. The New Age, couched the way it is just another word for religion. God became the universe and became a much more tenable for some people explanation of why things happen to them, as opposed to examining themselves and really understanding why things occur, understanding what they can do to, and you know, encourage change or take more control of their lives. They simply attribute it to something outside of their control, because if they attribute it to something within their control, it means they actually have to do something in order to get something.
Yeah, well, they secularized a lot of these things, because you could take these archetypes and you could package them up 100 different ways, and if you remove the polarity of religion, like you say, make it much more accessible to people, and you know, it still sells. But what gets me is that you could present this really very flimsy argument, and it has almost, it's baseless to me. If you're just curious enough to test it, if you just, okay, I'm going to try this. And because it's based on this very kind of flimsy languaging, it's almost like it's one of those things where people have say, okay, well, if I can't explain something, it must be because of the secret. It must be because of the... So instead of exploring further and getting more empirical or more direct with it, people just go, oh, I'll just take this lazy way out. And then when stuff doesn't happen for them, well, of course, they haven't done it enough, so they go back and buy more of this garbage.
Right.
It's the same reason why people buy self-help book after self-help book, and never get off that wheel, and they never make any changes in their life, but they just buy, they become addicted to the process of getting another map.
Well, and when they start attributing cause to effect, like for example, when they say that, you know, we don't get fat from eating too many calories or too much food, we get fat from looking at fat people. You know, I've looked at skinny people all my life too, and I don't find myself excessively skinny. You know, I worked in I worked in law enforcement for years and worked undercover with drug abusers and drug dealers, and I never became a drug abuser or a drug dealer. You know, but I was around those people every day. I mean, those things don't happen. That's not the way that goes. It's because, you know, people become drug dealers because they make a decision to be drug dealers. People get fat because they put too much food in their mouth, and they don't exercise enough, and they do all of those kind of things. You don't get fat, though, from sitting around looking at fat people. It just doesn't happen. Well, I guess if you just sat around and looked at them all day long and ate,
you're not moving around, you're not burning your calories.
Right.
Yeah.
But,
well,
you know,
is,
I mean...
There is some stuff, Dave, about having friends that gain weight and you gain weight. Not so much, they could be at a distance and you do that. This is something we talked about on the show before with body image. So that's the thing. A lot of this stuff is easy to misinterpret if you don't dig deep into the details.
Right.
You see a headline, you see a thing, and you go, oh, look, here's another. And if you really start studying, and I always try to tell people that, you know, we talk about the four domains here, which is basically subjective awareness and how your perspective can shift on a neurological basis, and then how does that organize itself socially and everything else. And if you understood and people gave you the way that the brain was designed and developed, and the way that cultures are designed and developed, you'd have an understanding of how certain ideas are always going to find a nook and a cranny into your head, and you have to be aware enough to be mimetically self-policing and saying, you know, I don't want that thought in my head to run my head because it doesn't give me any way to influence myself. I have to subjugate myself to this concept, and then, just like every other illusion, you have to maintain it in order for it to keep existing, which is why I think this thing keeps propagating, and I still see people signing up for the law of attraction, secret of the universe thing every weekend, and I don't understand how at a certain point that the stupidity of it exposes it. How do you get a bad idea to run its course? I mean, it will just become like a couple of years ago we had the bleeps, and then the bleeps gave way to these guys, and it just, because they hooked into business, they hooked into wealth consciousness now, which is the other big thing I see buzzing out there.
But see, they're really, all they've built on, all they've done is built a construct on top of an age-old construct that has always existed, and that's religion. And religion is an easy idea for most people to swallow because now most people are, you know, people forget what religion has done over the years. They forget that, and I'm not in any way suggesting that if you're a Christian or something that you shouldn't be, but here's the thing. Religion has done horrible things throughout the years. Religion is, you know, I mean, most people don't like, they don't like, when you really understand the Bible and you understand theologians, and you talk to theologians, they'll tell you that the Bible is full of political propaganda, that it was a book that was designed for, you know, for control and for spreading political ideas in its time. And, you know, there, and most real biblical scholars will not agree that the book is, you know, that the book is the literal word of God. But what's happened, though, is when big ideas spread, you know, mythology spread and exist because they're easy to accept and they explain a lot of things. Now, thousands of years ago, when people didn't know how lightning occurred, they said that there must be some being or deity up in the sky that throws lightning bolts. In fact, the Greeks had, you know, they had a god for that. And but as time went on, we began to understand things more. But the concept stayed around, the concept of a god. So this big idea, something bigger than us, controls us. When we can't explain, you know, we don't know what happens to us after we die. So when we can't explain those things, there has to be something attributable. We can't point to the moment that life began. You know, we can't point yet to the moment when the universe began, although we're getting closer and closer. Looking backwards with the Hubble telescope, they've been able to see within 100,000 years of the point of what they believe is the Big Bang, which created our universe. We can't see past, you know, many. So as we look at these things, as we expand further and further outward, we understand more. But when these people, you know, when you take something and you say, let's put a different cloak around religion and call it something different, we'll call it the New Age movement. We'll call it the Law of Attraction. We'll call it, we'll call it another kind of religion. We'll make it better because we do this. But they still attribute everything to something that's outside of themselves. That, you know, the Law of Attraction attributes anything that you get to something other than you. If you don't think well enough, you get something bad. If you think good enough, you get something good. But the problem with it is you victimize people either direction. And so all you do is you make victims who are legitimately victimized. If a woman gets raped, well, she somehow attracted that. Not only was she a victim of the rape, but now she's a victim of poor thinking and she's a victim of poor choices who knows how many lifetimes ago. And there's no clear path to erasing this. The rape didn't erase it because some people get raped four or five times in their life.
Every time something happens, you go back to this very kind of like, you know, simple map, and it's like, I thought good and bad happened to me. I didn't think good enough. You know, it creates, like I said, the need to repeat the to get more and more of the same catnip, thinking that you missed something the first time. No, they rooked you the first time. They'll rook you the 50th time until you, I guess, run out of money or wise up or once something happens.
Right.
But the same thing went on, you know, in the quote-unquote real world, with respect to the banking and everything else that happened in the housing bubble. People believed, and they were getting these incredible loans, and nobody was fighting them, and everybody was just like, okay, you know, this is the way. And there was a certain denial going on in that realm as well. That, of course, unfortunately for us, when it all crashes down, even the ones that were participating are affected. So if we steer this model from the secret, which I think we've wrestled to the ground now and tied it up like a little calf and move on, the persuasion industry that became very prominent once the web got popular in the .com era to get people to pay attention to things, and the whole idea of permission marketing and engaging people and opt-in and open source, it invited a lot of people into the game that were very good on the ground, and now all of a sudden they're everywhere, they're omnipresent. And one of the industries, of course, that ballooned up with this is coaching.
Right.
And I mentioned this at the top of the show, is that now you see more business coaching than life coaching, because now they've realized that, okay, we can't continue to do this there, we're not really psychologist stuff. So now, of course, there's a layer of people that adopted the entire secret thing, that there's a million people doing Law of Attraction coaching, I guess, out there, we need that. But the layer that's really getting powerfully influential is the elite or executive business coaching stuff that you do, actually.
Right.
And it's become much more of a fast-track way to get people who are used to working on the ground accommodated to working on the web and interactively. So tell us about that transition of you know, how coaching really became sort of a dying art and how this new industry has emerged on top of it, which puts the business layer to it, which makes it much more practical, pragmatic, and ultimately a useful tool.
Well, I think a couple of things happened. Number one, I think there were so many people who were certified as life coaches, and they were all taught a very similar set of processes that they were to give people to help them get a better life. And the problem with it is that those processes were designed just to elicit people, to elicit information. They weren't really designed to give people better skills. And so, I sort of like to attribute it to, or I sort of like to use an example of saying this. Listen, if I hire, I do mixed martial arts and Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Uh-huh.
And so when I hire a coach to coach me to become a better practitioner of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, he doesn't ask me, Dave, tell me how you feel about being a fighter. Tell me, tell me how you feel about this technique that's not working for you. Because if you can explain it and you can tell me how you feel, you'll come up with a better solution. Right? And Right, which is the kind of coaching a lot of people do.
Leading to nowhere, yeah. Okay.
Leading nowhere, right? Exactly, it's nowhere. Now, I might be able to tell him a whole lot of things. No, you know what he does? He grabs my arms, he moves my hands, he positions my body and says, okay, do it this way. No, you're moving your hips the wrong direction, move them in this direction.
You know,
put your hands here, do this thing, right? And so that's what people were really asking for. Now, some people obviously are looking for, more general sort of help. Some people, they need somebody to help them get to big picture thinking, but ultimately, just getting to the big picture, you have to drill back down to know what the action steps are to take, and that's what people were missing in most coaching, were those action steps, what to do next. And so, there's always been executive mentoring and those kind of things for CEOs and for executives. That's been around for a very long time. But what happened is, a lot of those people fell prey to, oh, I want to have a better life, I want more work-life balance, that kind of thing, and they got into these coaching programs. What they found out is they really didn't get specific step-by-step information, the kind of things that they needed. And so being business people, they started breaking it back down and saying, here's what I need. So they started looking for more of a consulting model of somebody who could tell them, or coaching, or a true coaching model saying, here's what you do next. Here's how you do it. And so as a result of that, the executive coaching industry began to grow, and there was a lot of room for people who were specialists, people who had specific sorts of knowledge and specific abilities that they could transfer to come in and train executives, teams, salespeople, all of those kind of things inside the organizations. And it wasn't just executives. I mean, it was also accountants and, purchasing people and everyone. If there was someone who could provide them with a specific level of training, short-circuit their learning process, all of that, then they were able to ultimately become more successful. And so they began hiring those people, and that's where, that's where the high-level coaching industry is going now. Now, there's still, thousands and thousands of coaches who are doing all kinds of other things too, but, the biggest majority of them don't make a good living at it, and, and ultimately they go away. But the people who are doing and providing really valuable skill sets, who are creating real change in people, that's replicatable, monetizable, and demonstrably better than, the person becomes demonstrably better than they were before, those kind of people are able to charge realistic fees because their profit, they're increasing the bottom line profits of a company by improving the ability of their executives.
Well, again, we're getting into this productivity efficiency angle here, where when you've got people so distracted, I guess, by constantly having to check email, constantly having to check their BlackBerry, constantly having to basically live in two worlds at the same time. When you have a coach that is able to digitally and analog, kind of do both, have the heart-to-heart conversation of how do you deal with, this meeting, this client, get you focused, mm-hmm. and then be able to distribute your digital activities, and like you talk about in your book about, getting into services like virtual assistants, things like that, mm-hmm. so that you're not literally trying to do everything at once. And the executives, usually because it's new, they get their hands on the new toys and they want to play with them. And
sure.
Part of the role of these business coaches, the ones that I've interacted with anyway, is to get you out of the minutiae and get you back into the more of a priority-based thinking, which is much more vertical thinking. And most of the teaching I've seen in the coaching fraternities anyway, it's much more horizontal, one step at a time, recipe thinking, which doesn't translate in the world of the quick and the dead, which is what the web is.
Right.
And this is why I've seen a lot of I used to call it ladling, where people will take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and they put this Frankenstein thing together, and it doesn't work. Like if I always say, if you put your Aurora you know, race car set, these slot cars together with your Lionel trains, and, you know, nothing's going to work here. So how do you get to the point where you can balance the art here? Because this is one of the things that, especially in the service industry, you know, I guess I was ordained as a chiropractor in 1991, right, and got into the NLP community, got into brain research, got into some other things. Mm-hmm. And once I entered into the somatic universe, which is fraught with a lot of people that have bought into some of these models, which didn't have my background, the kind of the cusp of it is, well, I'm a service provider, so I was trained to do a job, and it's nothing about what's going on internally to me. It's about how it can help. You know, if I'm interested in sports injuries, I go this way. If I'm interested in pediatrics, I go that way, and I focus on that community, I market to that community, and I master that community. I corner that market in my community on the ground, and then I try to take that vertically. That pretty much was the game plan. All of a sudden, .com era comes in. Everybody's getting their own little website stuff together, and it's like it becomes this whole thing about becoming a mini corporation into yourself, and this personal branding aspect comes in, where now it's all about me, and that's why all these things that get into these kinesthetic, internal, how do you feel, you know, the same old 70s psychology stuff comes back to haunt you, because now you got a bunch of people that don't have a lot of this business marketing training that are service providers. That basically, it's a vocational thing. You're trained to do a job. And now you got to learn how to promote yourself. And I was talking at the top of the show how it used to be doctors that advertise were looked at as being unethical. And now every doctor has to advertise. Every lawyer has to advertise. Every service provider has to promote themselves as a business unit of one. I'm unique. This is why you should come to me instead of going down the hall to somebody else. So how does somebody with very little, you know, I would say formal training in the marketing part of it and a lot of top-heavy training in the technical part of delivering a service, how do they balance that? It's all about you, personal branding, too. It's all about them, permission marketing, and stay solid and authentic and have a clear message.
Well, I think the important thing that people have to remember is that, you know, you do, number one, you have to just be clear. You have to set out and say, this is the message that I'm trying to communicate. This is what I want people to know. This is what I want to be known for.
Mm-hmm.
Brands are nothing more than the cumulative thoughts, experiences, feelings, impressions, and interactions that people have with a service provider or a product. So a brand isn't a logo or a color palette or any of those things. Those are just accessories to the brand. But a brand itself is really a psychological thing. It's a series of feelings and experiences and events that have occurred that people attribute meaning to, and that's what it becomes. So if you're someone who's trying to create a personal brand, or if you're trying to stand out, or you're trying to do these things either online or off or both, you have to make sure that what you're doing and what you're saying is congruent, you know, that experience meets expectation, and that you constantly do all of the things that you need to do in order to be, you know, in order to be perceived as the foremost expert, the most knowledgeable expert, and the person who is there to actually serve someone, or, you know, that your product is there to do a certain thing and that it actually does it. So it becomes a lot more about delivering an experience than it does about, you know, is red the right color for my logo?
All right, well, along those lines, we got some callers here. Maybe they got some questions on that front. So let's take the one from 916 area code. You're coming up somehow. See? You're on Summertime with Dave Lucani. What do you got? Hello. Oh, it's a detailed question, apparently. All right. You got to ask a question there, 916 area code. You're on the air. Okay, you're not on the air.
You're
let's
not thinking well enough.
Well, that law of attraction again. Let's go to area code 410. See if you want to talk. You're on Summertime. Got anything for us? Hello. I love this. All right. I'm not taking any more calls from 916 or 410. You have now attracted the wrath of the hang-up button. You guys can listen in. If you guys want to call in and listen, sometimes people on the West Coast are driving home, and they just want to call and listen. I don't know until I ask you the question, so if you're not there, I assume you're just putting the thing on the old speakerphone and you're tooling up the highway on the West Coast and trying to listen to me and Dave talk, so I will leave you be. East Coast, hopefully you guys want to ask a question, so we got a couple minutes left for doing that. Number again is 646-478-4847, so we got a couple of lines open if you want to get a question to Dave, or you can always email me at nakedsoma@gmail.com, and I will relay the question to Dave, and he'll get back to you in one of the many forms of communication that he travels through, which is a pretty hefty stream of information you're logging every day. I want to get to this list of people that I made here before the show, because you tend to rub elbows with most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sort of a message within each name that I'm going to mention here that represents a certain worldview that attracts a certain type of person that's going to be saying, I'll support this guy's work. So I'll start with a guy like Tom Peters. He's one of the uh-huh. original business guru guys, waving his arms and screaming. And he wrote books about thriving on chaos and all this edgy stuff. And now he seems almost ordinary. He seems almost like the establishment. Mm-hmm. And Michael Gelb, E-Myth guy, writing about being solopreneurs. This is all back, late 80s, early 90s. And then
Michael
you get
Gerber,
guys.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's his name?
Michael Gerber.
Gerber. I said Gelb. I don't know what I'm talking about. And then there's a whole wave of other guys that came in during the dot-com era. The first name I always think of is Seth Godin.
Sure.
Who's become another one that if you're in this world, you bump into Seth, and his bald head just reels you in because he's got a lot of things to say. And lately, maybe you've heard some of these names. I mean, there's been a new wave of guys that come out that sort of absorbed a lot of this information from guys like these, and they've created a whole other layer. And I'm thinking of guys like Michael Port. Okay, who was an actor in soap operas and was helping promote, fitness centers,
mm-hmm.
and is now one of the foremost internet marketers on the planet. He does his book, Yourself Solid stuff, and he's got a particular message that is completely distinct and 180 degrees from a guy like Tim Ferriss, work a 4-hour week, who says, automate, 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 do not be available, do not email people, do not interact. And Michael Port says, no, relate to your clients, brand yourself, And then I worked with Stephanie Hartman a while ago, who's more into, JV partnering and joint venture, all that kind of an angle. And then the next layer that came out of that was someone like Allie Brown, who got into e-signs and got into cross-marketing things that way. And now she's going into the womanpreneur angle of things with her magazine, things like that. So these are new people. The guerrilla marketing guys are there. The Ask Database guys are there. If you've been doing anything on the web in the last 4 or 5 years, you've met these people one way or the other, virtually or otherwise, and they've become megastars. Now, the one guy we have coming on next month is the guy that sells the Wine Library TV guy,
Gary
Vaynerchuk.
Z.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
You heard of him. Okay. He's now become a real kind of almost like a force in nature, I call him, at some of these business conferences, because here's a guy with no technical skills that to speak of, as he said, and literally picked up a flip cam and started talking to it and took what was a 400 square foot wine distributor and started selling wine on the web while he was just in the mid 90s. We're talking about a 386 computer. So these guys, to me, are evidence that there's multiple roads to get to this point where you have that integrity. There's multiple ways of doing it. There is no specific formula that says if you don't do step 7, everything falls apart. Because from Michael Port's perspective, it's all about you, the person, and exploring what your service is going to be, and because he works exclusively with service providers, where Tim Ferriss says, find a market, find a product, promote it, automate it, expand it, and go to Fiji. So there's multiple, sort of like the diet books on the shelf. How does the newbie to this environment, how do they read these things and not have their head going around in a circle like The Exorcist? How do you reconcile both these people get results, yet the messages are fundamentally and empirically completely different, yet they both work?
Well, it's best to look at what they do versus what they tell you to do necessarily.
Okay.
And so, most of their companies are founded on solid business principles. They're building a solid brand. They're building a solid company. They're doing all of the basics of business very well. Now, if you look at any of those people, those are lead generation tools that they use. Books are lead generation tools. Messages are lead generation tools. It's all of the kinds of things that you have to do on an ongoing basis that lead people to your message, and hopefully people will resonate with your message. And so it's telling the right kinds of stories that encourage people to say, yes, I want to be a part of that story, and they engage with you. And so all of those people, at the end of the day, I actually have kind of a big issue with the get-rich-quick programs, because you know people buy those things and they, you know, they get them and then they try one thing and it doesn't work for them. You know, what's smart, but everybody wants the magic pill, right? They want the quick fix. But in reality, if you're going to build a solid business, you need to build a solid business. And there are business principles that you do need to follow. There's proven principles that help businesses have the highest likelihood of succeeding. And you know, so if you base it on a strong model and a strong plan, your chances of success are much higher. And so, you know, when you listen to these people, I mean, if you want lifestyle design like Tim Ferriss does, and you want to work 4 hours a week, which Tim Ferriss doesn't, you know, and you but the concept is obviously that you can probably do a lot more with your life than you imagine that you can. And when you define work as doing things that I like doing, not things that I have to do, then you know, then you may only work 4 hours a week. And that's exactly how Tim defines it, which I think is, you know, I think is fairly brilliant. I work way more than 4 hours a week. I travel 180 days a year, and you know, and I spend a lot of my waking time doing things that are related to my business. But it doesn't feel like it because I enjoy doing it. It's just part of my life. But I'll tell you what, if I had to go out and mow lawns every day, or you know, pick a new ditch every day, or something like that, I wouldn't like that. That would feel a lot like work to me. And so I wouldn't want it to consume any more of my time than it absolutely had to. So, you know, by looking at the concepts and breaking the concepts down and saying, what is it that I'm really trying to, you know, what am I really trying to gain? Well, I'm really trying to gain independence, and this is my tool for independence. And so, you know, so can you learn things from every one of those people? The answer is absolutely yes. But the question you have to ask, when I learn something, you know, where does it fit in my model? How can I use it to move my business forward? As opposed to just getting really excited by something and saying, you know, this is my new motto now and this is who I am. You've got to stick with the basics.
Yeah, and again, this steers back to the concepts in your book, especially this very kind of eclectic thing called Chapter Zero, which I think is extremely powerful to read. If you haven't picked up Dave's new book, How to Sell While Nobody's Buying, that Chapter Zero is something that is essential, because when people are reaching for a book like this, especially in the, you know, ecology that we're in right now, they need results by Friday. If they're getting this book, they need to get something done. They can't wait 6 months to see a return on investment. They can't wait a year to see if this thing is going to be something they're going to carry through. They need something that's going to get them going right now. And a lot of things are like you said, it's the basics. When you get scared and when you get sloppy in business, you lose form. It's just like anybody else that's breaking down. You stop doing the fundamentals. You stop the callbacks with the old clients. You stop going back to the people that have been inactive for 2 or 3 months and reoffering them things. All the things you talk about in that Chapter Zero, it's basically a 5-day formula to get you back circulating and get you back interacting with your base. And then by using that as sort of a kindling to get you out, okay, I'm going to put some leads out there, I'm going to start meeting people again. Because what people do when they get troubled and they get stressed is they turtle up, and they stop interacting, they stop reaching out, and they start to basically kind of just hope, and maybe they pull out the secret DVD and hope everything works out. So the concepts in your book, what's the number one thing that would radically shift people's focus away from this survival mentality that is just pouring on them every single day, and get them into saying, okay, September's coming, school's coming, you know, all these things are happening. How do they make their September radically different than their August just by knowing one thing about what you're putting out in that book?
Well, there's a couple of things, actually. But, you know, the biggest thing is, if you look in Chapter Zero, it's just, it is going back to their base. It's going back and talking to people who haven't purchased from them before or haven't purchased from them for a while. It's going, you know, probably the biggest idea that you can use, and I've even automated this for people, if they want to use it for free, they can. But it's the idea of going to non-competitive people who are already selling into the customers or clients that you want to have and partnering with them. So if I come to you and I say, listen, you know, I've got 5 great clients who buy your products and services that are also buying mine. I'd love to introduce you to them personally. In return, I'd like you to introduce me to your top 5 clients who buy my products and services but are not competitive to you. And so then I make the phone calls, I introduce you, and you now have a warm lead. Well, we looked at this and said, how do we automate it? And it's called the Bold Approach Leads Machine. If you go to How to Sell When Nobody's Buying, and nobody's is NOBODYS, howtosellwhennobodysbuying.com, and click on Leads Machine, what we've done is we allow you to connect with other salespeople, dozens of salespeople who are ultimately doing this exact thing. So what I can do is you upload your contacts into this program, and what I can see is the company, where it's located, and the title of the person. So if I know that you have the VP of printer sales in Boise, Idaho, and you know, and I have the VP of of, let's just say that I have the VP of paper sales at at Boise Cascade, then I may want to, you may want to have my VP of paper sales and I want your VP of printer sales. So you say, hey, listen, I'd like to I'd like to trade you leads. Then we agreed to trade leads. Well, on the back end of that, and so then the exchange happens and you get all the information, I get all the information. On the back end of that, in an automated way, we've already gone out and we're constantly researching all of the information about the company, about the person online. If they have a Twitter feed, we're pulling that in. We're doing all of these things in an automated way. So when you get this lead, you now have a very warm lead. You can then ask the person you traded with, what is this person's, what is their buying cycle? Like all of these kind of things. And it's a totally free tool. You can get on that website just for going there and, taking 30 seconds and signing up. But that's probably the most powerful tool that anybody could use right now. There's literally thousands and thousands of sales leads sitting out there right now, opportunities for you to get connected with other people. The second thing that I would tell them is get on Twitter. If you want a better idea of what's really going on in the world today, get on Twitter and start searching for people who are having conversations about the products or services that you sell, or having conversations about the pains that lead to people buying the product or service you sell, and gently enter the conversation. Don't just slam them with the idea that, hey, listen, buy my thing because you said you needed it, but answer their questions, create a conversation. If you were at a cocktail party at your house with friends and somebody said, I've been having problems, with my car and I think I need some new tires, you wouldn't rush out to your garage and grab a tire and say, here, buy my tire.
Well,
but what you might
that's the error we're in is you can't go with that sort of the old way of marketing yourself, which
it doesn't work anymore.
Permission marketing. You know, people run the
right
other way.
Right, exactly. So what you might do, though, is ask them some questions. You might, say, hey, listen, have you thought about this or that? And, as it just so happens, I have some tires out in my garage. We can go take a look at them if you want. We might try one on if you like it. And then, they stay in charge of the conversation. But the point is that these conversations are happening all the time in real time every day. If you go to search.twitter.com and you begin looking for the conversations where people are talking about buying the products or services you have or talking about the pains they're having that your product or service sells, you'll find literally dozens, if not hundreds, of conversations at any given moment going on with people who could potentially be your customer right then. But most people won't do that.
Well, again, it comes from A, lack of awareness, and B, basically no firsthand experience of it, because when you enter into these social media environments, there isn't like someone's popping up in the corner and saying, this is how you use this tool. It's like you're thrown in the deep end of the pool, and then you try to figure it out later, and you grab for a ladder, and it's one of these guys selling you some, snake oil here, snake oil there, and pretty soon you're buying I want a Google click ad thing. And you get burned a couple times because you're basically not aware of what's good and what's not good. If you find someone like yourself that actually gives you real information instead of a lot of BS, you're lucky. So, if you guys are listening to this for the first time, it's building up both the credibility and also the visibility that's the difficult part on the web, because there's so many people selling so many similar things. Your book gets into that. The old concept is something I learned on the ground almost 20 years ago of cross-selling and saying, if I'm a body worker, I want to network with people that don't necessarily offer a body-based service. So the shrinks were my friends, and the educators were my friends, because they didn't compete with me. So
because you're a chiropractor, you may go to massage therapists. I mean, these are other body workers who already have the exact same clients you have.
Right, and you do piggyback sessions, and you say,
so
you can go one way or the other with it, but the thing is that you're never competing with other chiropractors to try. That's what they taught us in school, was to distinguish yourself from the other chiropractors. I was like, that's the last thing I need to do. I'm not even worried about that. I would network with the other chiropractors. I would talk to them. I would share clients with them all the time, because they'd say, my buddy down the street is much more happy working with pediatric cases, and I'm really trying to focus on sports injury cases. So, the kid has an older sibling, or someone that is in high school football, I do a training for the coaches every fall, so that they can prevent injuries, recover faster, and it never goes away. That aspect of being needy in sales, there's an old phrase: scared money never wins, and I think it's true in every industry, especially now. And that's why the cars for clunkers and all that stuff, all these things that are done to stimulate things, they're sort of artificial, and they don't have traction long term, because people get used to that type of wheeling and dealing, and they don't get back into the nuts and bolts of actually doing business, quote unquote, doing business with people, and networking, and actually having a community of people that won't have that sort of, you know, kind of hungry hippo grab at the client kind of a thing, because they're in dire straits, because they're on their knees, and they feel that scarcity come on, which gets right back into the New Age secret religion thing, because it's we have to think of abundance and. No. You have to think of what's practical and what's going to get A to B. And, you know, that search engine you're talking about, I took a look at it yesterday. I'll probably be hopping on it later on tonight, actually. I got stuff going on this weekend. Is that if you combine the speed of Twitter with the accuracy of LinkedIn, with the depth of LinkedIn, a search engine like that or a social media site like that, you not only just get leads, you actually get a sort of a new market to open up for yourself that is cross-selling, like you're talking about, my service with somebody else's service, which brings up a new industry, like you talk about in the book of, you know, a bakery and a wedding planner getting together, two things you wouldn't put together normally. Now, all of a sudden, they have a little networking going on. And, you know, this is something that I've always dealt with. One of the things I learned early on from some of my mentors was always market to people that are standing all day long. So it's cops, teachers, you know, firemen. It's like, because if you're dealing in an industry that's focusing on optimizing posture, well, the people that stand a lot, waitresses, things like that, they're going to be the ones today. This is my career here. And you get closer to people's beaches that way by being relevant and staying relevant and being able to be creative with that relevance. And that's one of the things I like about your work. I also kind of like the way the guerrilla marketing guy gets around it, too, because he's another one that sort of mixes up the message between what's enjoyable and freeing for me to offer you as a service. It's not something that's burdensome, like, say, the mowing the lawn concept, where it's just kind of like, you know, drill, drill, drill. And it's also engaging for the client, because now they're coming to someone who's receptive to their needs rather than deceptive to their needs, and they feel like they're being bait and switched and rolled around. And a lot of times, you know, that's why there's only two chiropractors left in Larchmont, me and the guy down the hall. There was 15 of us when I got here. There's only two left. And a lot of guys left to go sell shoes or something. They're not here anymore because they relied on, A, the insurance industry, and, B, a lot of BS, frankly, that wasn't really getting people's needs met. And so people get burned out on that, and it's kind of a scorched earth policy. You say chiropractor in any, kind of social setting, and people think, you know, reach for your back. They think pain because they've been looking at Yellow Page ads for 30 years that just talk about dysfunction. They don't think about intelligence. They don't think about vitality. They don't think about longevity. All the things I've been talking about since I walked in here. So it's a strange beast to sort of domesticate or sort of kind of own it. But what you're talking about in your book and all the things you've been bringing up tonight, it sort of reminds me of how I kind of got interested in interviewing you in the first place, is that as people approach a big shift in their consciousness, whatever it's going to be, whether it's a learning curve, whatever it's going to be, or getting involved on the web, you know, trying to market themselves on the web. As you talk about, and I just want to mention before we get off on this tangent a little bit, we're going to get into Kickstart America a little bit and some of the things, the early returns you've gotten with that, because that's another thing you did that I just sat there and went, wow, can't believe someone thought of this, is that as you approach this target that you've not been to before, just, you know, even say it's just a city you've never been to before. You're going to Saskatoon tomorrow, okay? As you approach this target, there's sort of a rebirth. It's sort of like you could forget everything that went before. You have no data. And at that point, you're either going to be wide open and receptive or you're going to do the clam. And how do you get people who are used to being in control of everything that happens because they're operating out of their familiar set to go to an unfamiliar place and remain open and remain receptive when they have absolutely no capacity to sort of, like, let their guard down? And that's when you see, like, the whole thing of, like, doing, like, people aren't good public speakers. They're good private speakers. They're good knee-to-knee, but they're not good in the room. And the whole idea in this mentality is you want to talk to bigger and bigger groups and get smaller and smaller subgroups out of it instead of going word-to-mouth, person-to-person. So how do you get community based sort of competency when people have been trained to be much more interpersonal in the way that they sell things?
Well, I think that I think that people are, you know, when you're trying to get them to go bigger and you're trying to get them to speak to the masses, you just have to teach them how to share their message in a bigger way. And so oftentimes what people do, you know, when you sell knee-to-knee like you're talking about, it's much easier to have a personal relationship with a single person. But what people forget when they're standing in front of a big group is what you do or what you say to one, you do or say to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really no different, but you have to use bigger word pictures. You have to get bigger group buy-in. There's lots of different tools that you use than you use one-on-one. In terms of getting people to do things they've never tried before, it's, you know, it's showing them a way that it's safe, that they're, you know, that they're going to be okay, that the outcome is better than not doing it, and that they, you know, that they have an opportunity to, you know, that they have an opportunity that they didn't have before. So just by giving people those kind of outlets, by showing them that there is a better way potentially and making it safe for them, it becomes something that they can do. I was just with my nephew today. At lunch at a Brazilian restaurant. He's 16 years old, and one of the things that they brought out were chicken hearts, and he had never had a chicken heart before. And it sounded sort of gross to him and disgusting to eat a heart, but he'd never tried it.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about it just for a minute and said, listen, you know, there's lots of things in life that you'll never tried before, and you won't know if you like them or don't like them unless you do. And part of growth and part of understanding who you are and what you're capable of and, you know, and developing your own personal power is, you know, is to try the things that seem challenging or that seem like you might not want to do them so that you have the experience and you know based on data, not based on emotion, whether something is true or not. And after we said that, he tried a chicken heart, and it wasn't horrible. He didn't hate it. He didn't want a bunch more of them, but he now had the experience. He now had data to rely on. If somebody asked him in the future if he wanted to try that, you know, would he try it? And he'd also done something that was challenging to him, so he had now conditioned himself at another level to become more effective. And that's what we have to do over and over again as human beings, and it is to recondition ourselves all the time to take more chances, to take more risk, to try new things, to get out of our comfort zone and continue to grow.
Yeah, and again, this is one of those things where if you don't have the proper sort of marketing parents, you try on a lot of false gods, you kiss a lot of frogs, and people get discouraged. And again, it's one of those things where you can't remove that from the template. There is a lot of trial and error with this. But the basics never go away is what you're trying to say. And that's what I keep hearing more and more from everyone I listen to about this kind of stuff. And this brings us back to Kickstart America. This is a program you started, I think, about a month ago, going around the country trying to get people that are basically living in tent cities, as you say, you know, in your message there. So tell us about... The genesis of it and how things have been kind of going since you started it.
When I was writing my new book, How to Sell When Nobody's Buying, I was doing a lot of research about what was changing in the economy. I've been studying the economy since it started changing a couple of years ago and trying to understand what it meant to small businesses and what it meant to corporations and everyone. And I started discovering that as large employers or whole industries were leaving certain parts of the country, that people were not just losing their job, but they were already living paycheck to paycheck. They were now losing their houses and their cars. They had no places to go. And many people were either living in their cars in safe parking lots or they were living in these tent cities. So they were setting up tent cities, literally, you know, hundreds of people living in tents all around the United States, and there's now dozens of these tent cities around the U.S. Some of the big ones are in Pinellas County, Florida, and in Phoenix, and in Reno, and Sacramento, and Seattle, and it goes on and on. And so I decided, you know, that I wanted to do something. I wanted to help these people who, through no real fault of their own, were suddenly not just unemployed, but they were now living literally in a tent. And help them find a way back, to show them, you know, to show them how to find jobs, where they're at today, to encourage them to learn the skills that they didn't have so that they could present themselves in a way they hadn't presented themselves in the past so that they could move forward, get a job that they needed. And so that's what I set out to do. So then I went out and I found 100, we call them the 100 helping hands. These are people, probably some, a lot of them are people like you've seen on, people that you've seen on Twitter. Rachna Jain, for example, or Denise Wakeman, or Bob Berg, and I'm not going to be able to list all 100 of them, but the list goes on and on and on. As you look at all of these people, you see, you know, people who have made, who stepped up to the plate and said, yes, I want to do something. I want to do, I want to help this out because I realize that these people are people like could have been my next door neighbors or somebody I might have known. So we put together Kickstart America, which is a program that originally we were going to go out and we were going to provide training at each one of these tent cities, but what we found out is that many of them were very transient. They could only be there for 60 days at a time, and then a new population moved in. So what we started to do instead is we're providing them with video training and all the technology they need, computers, projectors, screens, everything they need to then deliver the training directly to the people. And so they can have a facilitator facilitate the program. They can provide the training on an ongoing basis, and they can get the skills that they need to move forward. And the result has been phenomenal. Hundreds of people have reached out and said they wanted to help. And, you know, we've already visited the tent city in Pinellas County, Florida, began learning more. If you go to kickstartamerica.posterous, which is posterous.com, you can see the updates and photos and pictures of what we're doing. And we're going to keep expanding this as quickly as we can. You know, some of the other people that were, you know, that are involved in it, Dr. Molly Marty. There's just so many people, Terry Levine, which is at Coaching Guru on Twitter, you know, many, many people who are involved in this program. And we're going to begin bringing it to the media so that we can bring more media attention to this and really keep the program going. It's my belief that it's small business entrepreneurs, people who are listening to calls like this right now, are the people that are going to solve the problems that face our economy today. It's not going to happen by big government. It's not going to happen by more handouts or any of those kind of things. It's going to happen because private enterprise took the bull by the horns and did the right thing. It's going to happen because small businesses create one new job. It's going to be happening because you know that you have to do things differently and be responsible for your own independence now. You have to be independent, not dependent, in order to be successful.
Well, like I said, it's an amazing thing that you even thought of this, and it's even more remarkable that in the early returns are so positive, despite the, you know, the constant wind in everyone's faces of how bad everything is, and how powerless everyone's supposed to feel. I'm finding more and more people are saying, you know what, I'm sick of feeling like I'm powerless. I want to do something. And so The volunteer part of it, which is, again, goes all the way back to the business of service, we kind of looped around in here, there is a sense of much more of a community spirit when it comes to that. Because if you have something, you help somebody else, like you're talking about. Like Terry Levine doesn't need to get on a plane and go anywhere and help anybody. She could do whatever she wants. She's already made it out of the maze, so to speak. And to have that mentoring sort of trait and be able to say, you know what, it isn't enough just for me to make it out. I don't win unless I teach other people how to win. It dies with me. And that gets into the generational cycle of it, because I'm just seeing a different, maybe it's just because I've been around too long, I'm seeing a different affect from the greed is good era in the 80s to the, you know, the shareware kind of consciousness that's come up in the last 10 or 15 years, and has really sort of ingrained itself into business cultures, like you said, because the permission marketing, opt-in type of way of engaging people is much, much more popular than the traditional way of approaching yell selling, is what I used to call it, where everyone just shouts at everybody, and interruption marketing, I think, is what Seth called it originally.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've moved on. We're in a different era. Now we're in sort of that third wave of this. So we know what we did. We know what we tried to do to correct it. And now as people will listen, because one of the things about, you know, I interviewed Douglas Rushkoff about 3-4 months ago about his book Life Incorporated, where if you start getting much more into local communities, you start getting much more into a local currency, even, like he talks a lot about what goes on in the Berkshires. They have the Berkshires up there, which is money that's only good in the communities around the Berkshires. Well, you have a merchant community that is going to do this cross-selling kind of thing, that is going to basically keep their community whole and not let businesses slip away. That, to me, is a bottom-up type of rebuild. It isn't a top-down fix. And no matter what is coming out of Washington or coming out of the, you know, the corridor here that tells you that, you know, Papa Bear is going to take care of you, you're going to get more people basically waiting around for that train that isn't coming. So I'm really happy to hear that you guys are doing this and that it's so receptive to people. And I just wish there was a way to sell somatics to them, because if they knew how to walk and breathe and do all that stuff, they wouldn't be so tired and beat up in the first place. But that's probably another show, and I don't think you have any advice for me on that front. But if you do, I'm open to it at this point, because to try to market something that's kinesthetic on a visual medium has been a riddle. It's sort of like building the Sistine Chapel in the dark, I think, at some point. But, you know, I yoga was marketed well on the web originally, and then Pilates took over. Maybe somatics will eventually get on the stage, but the somatic community has to embrace it first. And I'm just one little yapster doing it. But maybe it needs to be introduced in a cross sell, and we can get it. We could teach car salesmen how to do it or something. I don't know. But anyway, I want to just kind of wrap up by we always kind of do this at the end of the show. What is the number one misconception about everything we've talked about tonight and all the things you're trying to get people to understand that you want to clear up for the Blog Talk Radio audience right now, so they don't leave the show going, well, I wish Dave explained this or that?
Well, I think that the most important thing for people to know is that that social media is changing the landscape of how we communicate. And I want people to know a couple of things. Number one, I think when people look at social media as a selling tool, they say that, you know, the more followers you have, the more friends you have, all of those kind of things matter. But it's not. It doesn't really matter. What really matters is looking at the quality of the people that you interact with and the level of interaction that you have with them. You know, smaller numbers can mean bigger returns from a profit. If you, in a profit situation, if you look at exactly what your relationship is with these people. And the other thing that people have to understand is that social media is changing the buying landscape, because people can literally find out anything about your product or service within about 30 seconds on Twitter. They can find out within a few minutes on Facebook whether or not your product or service is any good if they have any kind of a following at all. People will let them know what's working, what's not working, or they'll retweet it until they find someone who does. So, you know, products, services, businesses can be made or broken within a few short minutes by, you know, by one good experience or one bad experience. And, you know, you've got to be watching exactly what is happening around you all the time. You have to understand that that traditional offline friendships and networks are being replaced in some ways, or at least added to, by the friendships and connections that we make in social media. So if you're a salesperson or a marketer, you've got to be leveraging these new tools, and you've got to understand how they work, which is what we cover in How to Sell When Nobody's Buying, or one of the things. You know, you've got to begin using tools like the Bold Approach Leads Machine, which you'll find at howtosellwhennobodysbuying.com. You've got to do all of these things if you want to become effective in today's market, because if you're not, if you don't understand these tools, the market's only going to continue to evolve, and you're going to get further and further behind, and the further behind you get, the harder it is to ever dig yourself out of the hole. So, you know, the one thing I always like to remind people is that implementation is everything, and money follows action. Takes a simple idea, implement it, and you'll begin making money.
Wow. There's so many bumper stickers in my head. I'm just gonna go quiet here, because that was a lot of powerful things to end the show with. You definitely cleared up the misconceptions I had, so thanks for that. And I will be on that lead thing, trying to see if I can cross sell coherence somewhere. But we'll find out,
go.
I guess. But I thank you for coming on the show. I think you were a great guest, and hopefully that we can communicate down the line and bring this thing to another level. Kickstart America, if you guys haven't heard about it, it is something that if you watch the YouTube videos of it and you see the people that are going through these powerful transformations, it's something for me, as someone who's been in a small business, O&O for 19 years, to see people have their lives being, you know, reinvented is just special. And I applaud you for doing that. I think it's one of the most impressive things I've seen in this whole year of the recession, and I hope that people latch onto it and it continues to grow and becomes more popular. So it
gets more popular every day, thanks to guys like you.
Well, I appreciate your time, and thanks for joining us here this week. And we will be, hopefully the Blog Talk Radio community will be retweeting this thing and listening to it and getting your links and getting started with your work. And we'll get some archivers on there. And if you guys want to contact Dave, again, it's boldapproach.com. Follow him on Twitter. I'm sure after the show, if he wants to put any offers up for you guys for his material, he'll put it up on his site or on Twitter, and you guys can latch onto that. And
yeah, if they want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Dave Lakhani, which is DaveLakhani.
Cool. And anyone that missed that, just, you know, like I said, just pop me an email. I'll get that material for you. I always follow up with the guests. And thank you for joining us here tonight on Summertime. You were absolutely very informative, and I'm my brain is full.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks again for having me, and I'll look forward to doing it again sometime.
All right, Dave. Take care.
All right. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
All right. Okay. So I guess everybody's gone. Wow, that was instant. As soon as he hung up, they listeners were gone too. How does that work? So anyway, just sum up. We really covered a lot of ground tonight as far as how do you get the right brain crowd out of that mode so that the left brain crowd doesn't beat them up with all their practical, quantifiable stuff. And he gave us a bridge. He gave us a total bridge tonight to do that. And it always goes back to the one thing I always talk about, which is conversation. I think conversation is life. I've never separated the two words. And the most important conversation, of course, is the one you have with yourself. And most of that conversation isn't verbal. And most of that conversation that isn't verbal isn't conscious. Wow. What does that leave? It leaves you to STFU and look at the pictures. and get out the way. Get out the way. And he's talking about this. Don't fall further behind. Don't let this thing overwhelm you. Don't let this thing become so complicated you can't participate. Twitter is for morons. 140 characters. Morons. Most of them twitting things that are trivial. Okay? But in that ocean of minutia, there are guys like Dave giving you very, very practical, very, very doable information. And for free. For free. So, you know, that's something that's new. That we just have to pay for information like that. Dave costs a lot of money to go here and speak, believe me. And to get information from him, and he will interact with you. If you follow him, he follows you, and you can ask him questions. Because he is, unlike a lot of people in the business community, he is aware of the power of the web and the way to distribute information, and that's why he's doing what he's doing, and you and I are doing what we're doing. So learn from these kind of guys, and as he says, you know, use the dual probe of the passion, the emotional stuff he talked about, but wrapping it up in a very pragmatic and practical way so that you can impact people's lives and in a positive and lasting manner. And it's just unbelievable the way it's like a symphony, looking at the way he kind of wove all those things together for us tonight. So listen back to the show. Again, always can get a hold of me at nakedsomer@gmail.com, website somerspace.org. Check out the four domains. Lots of stuff to do because next week is September. Back to school after that, Labor Day coming up. So next week's guest is Tom Vanderbilt, author of the book Traffic, which gets into why we drive the way we do and what it says about us and our personalities. We're taking a lot of look at personality next month. And I'm going to be getting into that a little bit, digging down on that, and seeing how all of us fit together like one big puzzle and what the big picture looks like when that is all together. So hopefully we'll be able to do that for you here on Summertime over the course of the next few weeks with our special educated guests. All right, so again, thanks for listening tonight. And let me get the Buggles going again as we play out. There they are. Everybody out there with any questions about the swine friend, I'd be happy to answer them. I'm going to bat them out of the park. There is no secret, I'll tell you that. They are trying to exploit you. And that's why the health workers in Hong Kong are saying, oh, no, I don't want that thing. I think it's beautiful. All right, guys, thanks again for this time in your space. Travel light through the darkness. We'll see you next week on Summertime at 9 o'clock in the east. Travel light through the darkness, I said. Be well. Spiral On, Sapiens. That song is 1980. Ouch.